From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. We don't sound like any other radio program or podcast because we're not like any other radio program or podcast. Our slogan for almost 15 years of broadcasting is Religion and Radio Done Differently. Thanks for listening. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, on Tuesday, Mike Pence dismissed climate change science in the vice presidential debate. There are no more hurricanes today than 100 years ago, he said, at the fly debate. Well, from where I sit, in Louisiana, once again in the likely path of a record-breaking hurricane, far more important than number is strength. And in that measure, a storm today is 330% more likely to be deadly than one in 1920. It's a shame the unprecedented wildfires that continue to destroy California, primarily public lands set aside to preserve the environment for all. Well, that didn't even come up. Meanwhile, a small step forward for sanity as Facebook vows to block all of the anti-Semitic, pro-conspiracy, QAnon content that has been proliferating in recent years. Hopefully, better late than never. But I tell you, it's pretty late. And a curious snapshot from a recent Lifeway research poll of evangelical registered voters. In answer to the question, quote, what do you hope your presidential vote benefits the most? The option, people our nation has failed, garnered 15%. Meanwhile, the option, people nationwide who are like me, was the winner by far, with 41% making that choice. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
In front of the Supreme Court, knowing what this represents. And Father, for some of us, we've been praying for decades, God, to ultimately get to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. We know that's coming. We've been praying into the third justice that you said you were going to give us. And here we are. The nomination has taken place. They're saying in October 12th, they're going to do the confirmation and get started. So we're just declaring, you're setting the stage to take over these courts for your honor and glory. You're setting the stage to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Even as the vice president told a national debate audience that he has no idea what position Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett would take on reproductive freedom if confirmed, the extreme political religious right can't help but give itself away. And then there's the chilling claim by two justices that the groundbreaking Obergefell decision was an assault on religious liberty. We'll get the terrifying details from People for the American Way senior fellow Peter Montgomery.
The Department of Corrections says there have been over 10,000 total confirmed cases of inmates with COVID-19 and 58 deaths at prisons statewide.
This week, a diverse coalition of activists in California took part in a banner drop day of action, demanding that state and federal government address the unconscionable COVID-19 risks faced by thousands of prisoners and undocumented persons. We'll get a first-person account from the Reverend Deborah Lee, Executive Director of Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity. But first,
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Those words still echo in the ears of Americans who understand just how they were heard by some of the most dangerous and partisan extremists in our nation. They also only escalate further our concerns about what our society is likely to face after the election, regardless of the outcome. For an expert look at that kind of language, as well as what's probably already in place, I'm joined by Helio Fred Garcia, author of the book Words on Fire, The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It. So, Fred, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Delighted to be back.
So, who would you expect to hear those words, stand down and stand by, from the President of the United States as directed at them?
Well, one of the things that I do in Words on Fire, Welton, as you know, is I describe what I call Trump's dance with white supremacists. And it follows a predictable pattern. And that is, he signals to them and they signal back. And in particular, when he's asked to denounce white supremacists, he follows another pattern, and that is a four-step process. The first is to deflect the request to denounce white supremacists. When pressed, the second is to diminish the significance of the white supremacists. The third is, in a tone of voice that suggests he doesn't really mean it, to speak some language of criticism or condemnation. But the fourth is to resume the prior language. We saw precisely that after Charlottesville. And when he said good people on both sides, David Duke sent a thank you tweet, and the Daily Stormer sent a note to its neo-Nazi followers saying he loves us. Invited to denounce us, he declined to do that. He did the same thing after the New Zealand shooter when he was asked at an event to denounce white supremacists. He followed the same pattern. He did the same thing after El Paso, and we saw him do it when he was invited to denounce the Proud Boys. And he began by deflecting, I don't know who they are, what do you want me to say? Then he diminished and said, look, there's lots of blame to go around. It's also Antifa and the far left. The next day, he did the tepid denunciation. He said, I don't know who they are, but they should follow the law. And then he was right back using divisive language. That is a pattern. It is not surprising that within an hour, the Proud Boys had taken Stand By and Stand Back and put it on their logo and started selling merchandise with it. It is precisely that dance that we have seen, whether it's with the Daily Stormer, the neo-Nazi group, or with David Duke, or with Richard Spencer, or with QAnon. We see the same pattern, and it is profoundly dangerous.
Yeah. Fred, it was 2016 that Donald Trump cryptically referred to, quote, Second Amendment people doing something about judicial appointments a president, Hillary Clinton, might make. Later, he's made repeated and unforgettable references to his supporters having most of the firearms, claiming he has the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. Things were not as tense in America when he said those things then, but what do we need to honestly consider as possible as we sit here today?
Welton, one of the patterns that I point to is as Trump gets more and more desperate, and as he feels more and more that he is being put upon in a time frame that is difficult, say an election, he escalates his rhetoric to create an invented crisis that calls for some kind of armed response. Now, when he was a candidate in 2016, he didn't really have that power. But we saw a preview of what can happen in the next few months back in June and July. And that is during the Black Lives Matter protest, when some people who were not Black Lives Matter protesters began to commit acts of violence against property and against people, the president exaggerated the risk and he called for the mobilization of the active duty military. He even called up the 82nd Airborne, who arrived in Virginia and Maryland with automatic weapons with fixed bayonets. His Secretary of Defense, on a conference call with the president and with mayors and governors, talked about, we, the military, will dominate the battle space that is American cities. And that was too much for retired Defense Secretary James Mattis. And General Mattis took to The Atlantic and The Atlantic magazine, and he denounced first Secretary Esper and then President Trump. He said of Secretary Esper, "Secretary, it is completely inappropriate for you to be using the language of battle space to be nominated when you're talking about American cities. That is dangerous, it is unconstitutional, and I'm calling you out on it. You can't do that." Then he turned to the president and said, "Mr. President, my entire time in your cabinet, I never once heard you use language to unite, only to divide. What you're proposing is both unconstitutional and dangerous, and you need to stop." General Mattis was modeling what engaged citizens and civic leaders and public figures need to do. Now, the president dropped his idea of mobilizing the active duty military, but then he mobilized fatigue uniformed, non-insignia wearing troops who turned out to be Department of Homeland Security police, but without any insignia as to who they were individually or which units they were with. They began rounding people up in Portland and putting them in civilian vehicles, the kinds of things you see in a police state. And when he finally couldn't get away with that, he dropped it. I worry about his using the instruments of power in the aftermath of an election that he purports to have been illegitimate. And I'm worried that some elements of the U.S. government might go along with him, especially those under the command of the Department of Justice, ATF, folks like that, or under the command of the Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, ICE. I am pretty confident that the U.S. uniformed military will refuse an unlawful order or the invocation of the Insurrection Act, but I'm less confident about people who report up to Bill Barr or people who report up to the Department of Homeland Security acting secretary.
Are these irresponsible statements more likely to activate organized militias and far-right groups, or do they serve as the kinds of lone wolf whistles that you write about in your book?
What incendiary language, the language of dehumanization of groups, the language of demonizing of rivals, the creation of a fake crisis calling on citizens to take action to protect the nation, all of that is right out of not only the authoritarian playbook, but out of the lone wolf whistle playbook that I describe in Words on Fire. And that is language that creates social conditions that inspire some people to take up arms and to commit acts of violence. Now, the phrase organized militia that you used in your question is an interesting one, because militia typically is intended to mean some unit of government. But here, private citizens have taken on the label militia. They call themselves militia. What they really are is armed gangs. And they don't have any command and control. And in that sense, they really are lone wolves. In this instance, they are lone wolf packs that are operating collectively, but without command and control, but rather they've been inspired by signals, which I call lone wolf whistles, from, in this instance, their hero, the charismatic leader in charge. Whether it is private citizens acting solo, the typical lone wolf, or the so-called militias acting collectively, which we might call the lone wolf pack, both of those are dangerous because both of those see that they have been given permission by the president to take up arms. We saw precisely that in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in the case of the individual lone wolf who happened to be a teenager. But his mother took him across state lines with semi-automatic weapons in violation of every conceivable kind of firearm law. So that isn't even in alignment with the Second Amendment, because even the Second Amendment says there are rules about where you can take guns and who can carry guns, and a 17-year-old cannot.
Fred, what do you foresee for our nation in the weeks after November 3rd, and is there even a realistic way we could prepare for that kind of scenario?
One of the things that will make violence in the streets less likely, in my opinion, is an overwhelming, clear victory by Biden. The closer it is, the more the president can assert that it was rigged, it was fixed. He has been using the false narrative, as you know, of talking about mail-in ballots as capable of fraud. He's talking about universal ballots. He is suing states to prevent them from sending not ballots, but ballot applications. But he conflates the ballot application with the ballot. And he's building a public context in which he can challenge the legitimacy of the election. The bigger the gap between Biden and Trump, the less likely he can get away with it. But the other thing that can happen is exactly what you and I are doing now, that we've seen Rachel Maddow do on MSNBC and others in positions of influence, and that is to name this as the pattern and to call this out as the risk and to begin to equip citizens to anticipate this happening so that they can act quickly if it should happen, to say, that's too far, you can't do that. We've already seen leaders in the military begin behind the scenes to say, I will not allow my troops to follow an unlawful order. We will stand down if we have to. And that's an encouraging sign. Again, I worry about those elements of the government that are not professional military, but that are controlled by Attorney General Barr or by the Department of Homeland Security. But at this point, it is awareness raising and equipping citizens the way you are doing on this program today to anticipate that this is a possibility, if not a likelihood, and to have the capacity to respond quickly to say, you cannot do that. We will not allow you to get away with it.
Fred, you recently wrote a powerful article headlined "The Consequences of Misinformation, Trump, Largest Disseminator of False COVID-19 Information." And that was before the outbreak in the White House. Please talk about the pandemic of untruth, if you would.
Well, as you know, one of the hats I wear is I'm a professor of both ethics and leadership and also of communication at both New York University and Columbia University. And I take seriously the need for civic leaders to speak the truth. And one of the stories that got lost was a very, very detailed and deep report by the Cornell University Alliance for Science. And it was published Thursday afternoon, less than 48 hours after the Proud Boys reference at the debate, but about 5 hours before President Trump announced that he was positive for COVID. And as a result, that report from Cornell was essentially lost in the news cycle. It looked at more than 3.5 million pieces of English language content between January and the end of May of 2020. And it identified in particular 1.1 million news stories that had misinformation about COVID-19. And it did an analysis of the kinds of misinformation there. And it reached a conclusion that 37% of the news stories had a statement that was false about COVID-19 attributed to the President of the United States. So 380,000 stories in English language news media attributing to the President of the United States false information about COVID-19. The Cornell study further concluded that it was likely that more than 50% of those stories actually had misinformation that was traceable to the president, but there were many, many stories that had the same misinformation as had been attributed to the president, just without the president's name. So somebody else would take what the president said and then repeat it. They categorized the misinformation, the most common, and again, this is between January and the end of May, the most common, with nearly 300,000 stories, were stories about miracle cures, about hydroxychloroquine, about injecting disinfectants into your body. Now, that's even before the stories we've seen in the fall about this vaccine that is right around the corner, that you and I both know is not right around the corner. But what is troubling is the second most common form of misinformation, more than 50,000 stories, was attributing the COVID-19 phenomenon to the so-called deep state and the conspiracy that said there really isn't a COVID-19, it's really a deep state conspiracy to embarrass President Trump. The third most common was 40,000 stories that attributed COVID-19 as being a Democratic Party hoax. Now, there are meaningful consequences of this. Dr. Erwin Redlener, the director of the Center for Pandemic Resource and Response at Columbia University, has done a statistical analysis and has concluded that if we had gone to a national masking policy in March, if we had gone to a national work from home policy in March, if we had had consistent masking and social distancing in the United States, fully 150,000 of the more than 210,000 people who have died would not have died. And that is a tragic consequence of misinformation.
Fred, you have a long and successful history in crisis communications, and I can't have you on here today and not ask you, what were your thoughts as you watched the Harris-Pence debate this week?
Well, we learned a week ago the need for someone to be able to turn off a microphone. And although he did it in a less brutal manner, Vice President Pence behaved similarly to the president from a week ago. And that is, even though he had run out of time and even though the moderator signaled to him 2, 3, 4 times, he continued to speak over the moderator, Susan Page, and he continued to speak over Senator Kamala Harris. She, to her credit, would simply look at him and smile and say, "Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking." I believe that he was attempting to get her to become angry, and she instead kept her cool, and I think the vice president came out on the wrong side of public opinion on that debate.
Yeah. In these crucial last weeks before Election Day, what should citizens who want to be informed and prepared be focusing on?
They should be focusing on the gap between what the president says and what science and observation prove to be true. And the president says that there's rioting in the streets. Don't believe it. Look for yourself. When the president says that there is fraud in the elections, don't believe it. Look for yourself. Find people who are considered experts before the president was in office. Look to the reliable sources. Don't depend upon someone who is the leading proponent of misinformation about both COVID and about civic life.
Fred Garcia is a professor of ethics, leadership, and communication at Columbia University and New York University, the founder of Logos Consulting Group. Fred is former chair of the board of Interfaith Alliance. This summer, he published his latest book, Words on Fire, the power of incendiary language and how to confront it. Fred, thank you for sharing your insights with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Reverend Deborah Lee of Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, and later Peter Montgomery of People for the American Way, on the extremes to which the political religious right is going to anoint Amy Coney Barrett as God's own SCOTUS nominee. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. While electoral politics and self-inflicted health crises have understandably held public attention, a diverse coalition of interfaith activists in California took major steps to address the risk faced by prisoners and other vulnerable persons in the ongoing pandemic. With a first-person look, I'm very grateful to be joined by the Reverend Deborah Lee, Executive Director of Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity. Reverend Deborah, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Tuesday, there were protests across California at prisons and immigration centers led by your group and others. Talk about what prompted that.
Yes, we have been for months now, since the outbreak of COVID-19 and since most of the rest of society has gone into shelter in place, especially here in California, we have been very concerned about the conditions inside jails, prisons, and detention centers in our state. We are well aware of the situation of overcrowding, extreme overcrowding, to the fact that courts have even ordered that they should be reducing the population size. And we knew it was just a matter of time before the virus would enter into those very overcrowded situations and be, you know, just like cruise ships and nursing homes. You know, we knew that this was also going to be a place that there would be many people who would be impacted and many people who would die. And that's already been the case. We started about 6 months ago, really trying to draw attention to this situation, because we know that, for example, in the situation of immigration detention centers, immigration detention is completely unnecessary. It is a choice of the government. It's not required by the government to detain immigrants. They could be releasing people on alternative to detention programs, on their own recognizance, on some kind of bond, other kinds of ways. They don't need to be detained while their immigration cases are going through the court process. It's completely unnecessary. And also we realize that even in the prison population in California, there are many people who are, I think it's something like over 50% of the population have a pre-existing condition. There are a lot of elderly prisoners because of California's prison boom in the 1980s. There was a lot of locking people up and giving them 20, 30, 40, 50-year sentences. So there are a lot of older men and women in our prisons who we knew were extremely vulnerable and also who have served more than enough time. Many of them have changed their lives and, kind of also we feel being unnecessarily imprisoned, especially during this unprecedented global pandemic.
Yeah. What were the specific demands you're making?
Yes, well, our major specific demand, you know, the event we had on Tuesday was really focused on Governor Newsom, who in some regards has done well around, you know, as best as he can around the COVID pandemic, but has been remarkably silent in terms of our brothers and sisters who are incarcerated. So we've really been trying to ask him to do more in terms of his executive authority around this issue. And he is in charge or oversees the administration of all the state prisons, the 32 state prisons in the state. So our demand, number one demand, was really that they significantly reduce the population size, that the population sizes have got to go down. Public health experts at the University of California at Berkeley have said that for prisons really to be safe during a pandemic need to be at 50% population. They were at 130% of their, prescribed population. They've kind of come down to about 100%, but they're still way too many. So we're asking for more clemencies. There's a lot of things that are in his power to do. There's the clemencies that he could be doing. They've kind of stopped looking at ways they could look at more COVID releases, people who are vulnerable conditions. There were about 8,000 people that he looked at that said, that, oh, these are people who, are at high risk, and very few of them have actually gotten out. So very frustrated about that process. Family members are terrified. There have been major outbreaks in about 5 of the prisons. San Quentin, people may have heard about. There's been over 2,000 cases of COVID, including and a significant number of deaths. There's been over 90 deaths in California of people who were encaged while they had COVID-19. That's mm-hmm. in our prisons, our jails, and our detention centers. So the first thing, going back to your question, was more releases. The second thing was to halt the expansion of immigration detention facilities. It's hard to believe, but during this COVID time, the private prison companies and federal immigration, customs and enforcement are trying to expand three detention facilities in California. And that is kind of an anathema to think about putting more people into these confined spaces during this time. So we're asking him to stop that, to not allow them to do that, that this kind of goes against public health advice. The third thing was to stop transfers and that includes transfers between prisons, because that was how the spread of COVID has happened in our California state prisons. People being transferred from one prison to another prison has actually been the transport, the expansion of the virus. And then also what we're seeing happen, which is really concerning to us, is that the governor and the California prisons are allowing Immigration, Customs and Enforcement, ICE, to take people who are being released from prison. Like, they could be being released from prison because they served their time. They have paroled out. They've been deemed safe to release, to come back to their families and to reenter society. And they're allowing ICE to intercept them before they actually are able to meet their families in the parking lot. So that is a practice that we absolutely believe is counter to our faith values, because mm-hmm. we believe in second, third, fourth, fifth chances. We believe in forgiveness. We believe in redemption. We believe that people have served their time. They shouldn't be being punished doubly or triply again. And to allow them, they've upheld their contract to like serve their time and rehabilitate, and then we're sending them back into immigration prisons for deportation.
Have you been able to gauge if there was any immediate impact from that banner drop day of action?
The banner drop day of action, I think it's too soon to tell. This banner drop action, I want to say, has been just the next thing in a series of actions that we've done. There were people who were arrested who had, it wasn't the faith community, but more some of the younger activists and lawyers had chained themselves to the governor's mansion. With the same list of demands, about 12 of them did that a few months ago. The faith community has sent a letter signed by 600 faith leaders across the state of California urging the governor to stop the transfers and to increase clemencies and reduce the prison population in the face of the pandemic. We have met with his office staff. So there's a lot of things that have been done, and the banner drop action was just like one more way to really show that there are communities and families across the whole state who are affected by this and who are really terrified for the well-being of their loved ones. And we just want to see some kind of movement. I mean, It could be the sick. It could be the elderly. It could be the blind. It could be the disabled. It could be the transgender. It could be so many of the vulnerable populations who are imprisoned right now. And we're just not seeing an act of compassion and an act of clemency on his part.
What's blocking the releases that your coalition is advocating? Because I know that there have been some releases in California of the prisoners. What's stopping it now?
There have been some, but I think there have been very few. There have been talk of more, but when we actually look at the reality, the people who have been released were by and large natural releases. There were people whose time was up. They were going to be coming up for release anyway. And there are cases where people whose time was up, they finished their time, and then they got transferred to ICE. So what is blocking this is I feel there's still a lot of politics of fear at play, and that's what's disappointing. It's disappointing that people are still, and I think the governor to some degree himself, is still using this fear of the stigmatization of people who have spent time in prison or who are in immigration detention, the stigma of like, oh, you know, can they be released and where are they going to go? I mean, he even said, you know, where are they going to go? And what we've been trying to express, standing side by side with families at that banner drop, there were families in those locations who are pleading for their loved ones, saying, well, we are here. We want to take care of our loved ones. We don't think that the prison can take care of them with COVID-19. We have a place for them. That's my guess, yeah, is what's going on, is this politics of fear of if they release someone and, God forbid, somebody does something in the future, it's going to come back to him, right? I think we have to have a different understanding of why does crime exist? Yeah. You know, what are the conditions that lead to crime? There's been so much disinvestment in Black and brown communities in California that have been completely abandoned for decades in terms of decent jobs, in terms of decent schooling, in terms of health care, in terms of parks, in terms of programs for young people. I mean, there's communities not far from where I live that have been abandoned since World War II, effectively, by in terms of government investment. But actually, crime has been going down, and that's the reality, is that crime has been going down. And so we feel like we want to continue to move with this in this direction, and everybody in prison, should not be having a death sentence, and that's kind of the situation right now.
How many people would be eligible for release?
I think if our demands were met, I don't know the exact number, but I think we're talking about tens of thousands of people, maybe 40,000 people, 50,000 people could be released. There's so many good people who could contribute to their families, could contribute to their communities. And we really think that this is a moment that these things, that people need to be looked at as humans and with some compassion. So that's what we're hoping. We're trying to push California to decarcerate. We were the start of the prison boom that went crazy across the country in the 80s. And we want to see that happen because we want to see the investment of money in our state go to so many of the needs that our community has in terms of housing, affordable housing, and community programs and senior programs. Like, there's so many needs we have in the communities that we would really like to see this money divested from more incarceration and really put into long-term sustainability for our communities.
Our listeners will be asking, why is this the priority for your faith-based activism? And I'd like you to address that. And then tell us, how can listeners find out more about Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity and follow your work?
Thank you for that question. The Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity is, believes that every person is sacred. And we have found that that is a common denominator of our different faith traditions, and that we have really felt it is important to bring people of faith together to work on social movements, be engaged in social movements where that is not evident, where the sacredness of every person isn't being practiced, mm-hmm. where there are huge stigmas that somehow cast others, you know, people as other, people as unworthy, people as, oh, they're not part of society, or they can never be. So we really felt that it was our faith calling to focus on people whose humanity has been most denied, mm-hmm. and that was a specific calling for the faith community. You know, there's others that might be easier to other projects that might be easier to do, or other movements that might be easier. But we felt like, you know, as the faith community, this is something unique that is one of our values to really lift up the humanity. So we've really looked at, like, where are there the greatest stigmas, and we've looked, and so that's brought us to look at undocumented immigrants,
sure.
where there's a huge amount of stigma, and then people who are imprisoned and in jails, where there's another kind of huge stigma. And we felt like that was so important for us to be able to say, if we can shine a light that they too are human, they too are part of us, that we actually are co-responsible in many cases for the situations that have led to, like, these systems, have led to people being forced to migrate. That's part of our shared societal responsibility. That was a really important role for the faith community to be standing in that space and to be standing with those families and those communities. So please join us on our website, which is www.im4humanintegrity. I'm for humanintegrity.org.
Reverend Deborah Lee is Executive Director of Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity in Oakland, California, working under the credo, I love this, all people are sacred across bars and borders. Reverend Deborah, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
In late September, the ever-ascendant political religious right threw itself the annual party that it calls the Values Voter Summit. Presented by the multimillion-dollar hate group Family Research Council, the gathering included many of the stars of far-right American political religion, including this year the most partisan Secretary of State our nation has seen, Mike Pompeo. People for the American Way senior fellow Peter Montgomery usually takes the risk involved in covering this event, and I am happy to have him back with us again on State of Belief Radio. So welcome back.
Thanks, Walton. It's always great to be with you.
Peter, I understood it was more of an online event this year. What stood out for you at VVS?
You're right. That was the big change, was that it was all online. So weren't able to stroll through the exhibition hall and pick up our research material from sponsoring organizations. But in some ways, the biggest thing was the way that things were the same. You know, for example, Tony Perkins, the head of Family Research Council, used the platform to smear opponents of Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination as, you know, anti-religious and anti-Christian. And it's an old tactic, but it's one that they never give up. And so that was on display.
So it wasn't just hearing what you've always heard before.
Well, no, I think it's a little bit different in that, you know, President Trump has been, for them, the dream president. He has given them what they wanted. He and Mitch McConnell are filling the federal courts with unqualified ideologues who basically, if they're young enough and right-wing enough, McConnell and the Republican Senate will put them on, no matter how unqualified they are. And so there's a strange mix of triumphalism that they have been winning a lot under the Trump administration, with a desperation of seeing that all slip through their fingertips if Trump loses. And so there is a ramping up again of an old tactic, but to a new level of fear-mongering that a Democratic victory would mean the end of religious freedom in America. That's a scare tactic that they used in 2016 to get Christians to vote for Trump in spite of his myriad character flaws. And they're using it again. And they're really hoping to ramp up that fear factor in order to keep people voting for Trump in spite of his, you know, deadly mismanagement of the COVID virus and everything else. And Trump is picking up on it. Trump was tweeting out that Democrats want to shut down churches permanently. You know, it's such a ludicrous lie that you don't feel like it's even worth any attention. But that's coming from the president of the United States.
Did you get any insight into what kind of strategies may be putting together for the days after November 3rd?
Well, I think that they are intimately connected to the White House and the White House political operation. And so they are certainly supporting Trump's efforts on voting, supporting the lawsuits that the Trump administration is involved in to stymie state efforts to make it easier for people to vote during the pandemic. And they are also embracing the Trump administration's rhetoric about Democrats trying to steal the election. So I think if there is chaos in the wake of the election, if the result is not immediately clear to everyone and Trump decides to stir up trouble, he can very much count on the religious right to be part of the troublemaking.
So we're watching the outrageous campaign to push Amy Coney Barrett and her almost 3 years of lifetime judicial experience through the confirmation process, while lawmakers pretend she's simply the best qualified candidate in the nation, the theocratic right is tipping its hand. Talk about how they're saying she's quote unquote anointed.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating thing. You know, people have focused on the fact that she is, you know, a conservative Catholic and part of this charismatic Catholic movement. But I think it's fascinating the sort of the Pentecostal wing of the religious right, the apostles and prophets who promote Trump as God's anointed, have declared that she has been anointed by God to bring about an end to abortion in America. And some of them started saying that in 2018, the last time there was a vacancy, and they were so convinced that she was God's candidate that when Brett Kavanaugh rose to the top instead on one of the prayer warrior calls that I listened in on, Kavanaugh was denounced as a usurper, that he was usurping this position from the person who God intended to have it. So that is how committed they are to getting Amy Coney Barrett on the court. And it's explicitly tied to the fact that they believe that she will be the final vote they need to overturn Roe v. Wade and push toward their end goal of criminalizing all abortion in the U.S. That's been their top goal. But for the Trump team, they also want her on the court right now so she can vote with the other court conservatives to demolish the Affordable Care Act in the middle of a pandemic. And so that's particularly egregious that Republican senators are avoiding public health guidelines and common sense and everything else to try to push her onto the court so she can be there when the court hears this challenge to the Affordable Care Act a week after the election.
Well, Peter, of course, we know many millions of Americans would like to see Roe v. Wade reversed, most often on religious grounds. How closely are the extremists that you profile working with more mainstream Catholics, evangelicals, and others?
They're all on the same team when it comes to the Trump administration. Some of these leaders, like Lou Engel, who's been an anti-abortion activist for decades, He sponsored an event on the Mall in the early years of the Trump administration, in which he, you know, led prayers for God to remove Supreme Court justices. And he has led such prayers many times. But this event did not just include him and other Dominionist self-appointed prophets like Cindy Jacobs, but it also included the mainstream, if you will, of the anti-choice movement, Marjorie Dannenfelser of the Susan B. Anthony list, and other anti-choice activists. So they're all working closely together. They're all intensely motivated to get Barrett on the court, come hell or high water or COVID. And they are intensely motivated to put Trump back in the White House so he has four more years to pack the federal courts with the kind of judges that they've been getting.
Is there any credible activism happening on the other side in secular circles as well as on the religious left? Or is this simply a one-sided campaign with an outcome that's predestined?
No, I would say there is definitely a credible campaign on the left from advocates of the right to privacy and reproductive choice. You know, there's a tremendous amount of organizing going on in the states of senators who are going to be voting on this. The problem is that the way the Senate is running now under Mitch McConnell, the number of tools that are available to the Democratic senators is limited. And, Mitch McConnell, runs the Senate like his personal fiefdom. He has made his top priority the confirmation of judges, and particularly now a Supreme Court justice. He's setting aside relief for millions of Americans who are impacted by the pandemic, because none of that is important to him as packing the courts. And so there is a credible campaign. People all over the country are working very hard to try to derail this, but it may not be enough.
Yeah. Well, just as important, Peter, is what Justice Clarence Thomas wrote earlier this month about the Obergefell decision. Talk about why this is such a concern.
Yeah, I think that a lot of Americans, most Americans probably, who don't spend their time like I do listening to right-wing media, would probably be surprised to know that, you know, the religious right has never accepted the Obergefell decision, that they have never accepted it as legitimate. And even after marriage equality being the law of the land for the last 5 years, they are absolutely intent on overturning that decision and stripping same-sex couples and their families of legal recognition and legal protections. And, you know, they're not scared to admit that. The Anti-Equality National Organization for Marriage is beside themselves with glee at the idea that Amy Coney Barrett could be the vote to overturn Obergefell. Ryan Anderson at the Heritage Foundation, which has been vetting judges for the Trump administration, Ryan Anderson is one of the most vocal anti-equality advocates out there, anti-marriage equality advocates. And even before the Supreme Court decision came down in 2015, he was laying out a roadmap to see it overturned. So I think the good thing about Thomas and Alito was they made that a little more evident to Americans, this campaign of resistance to marriage equality, this intention to overturn it, I think has been pretty much under the radar for most people. And Thomas and Alito at least made the threat clearer.
Well, sadly, a lot of this is not a surprise, of course, but it is disappointing beyond words that more Americans let down their guard in the past decade or so, taking progress for granted and failing to imagine the kind of wholesale assault on rights that we're seeing today. With that in mind, Peter, what should we be having nightmares about going forward?
Well, you know, take your pick of the issues that are important to you. I think if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, you will immediately see a number of states criminalizing abortion. And not only that, but, you know, they're when they're trying to dismiss people's concerns, they say, well, this is not ending abortion. This is just making it, turning it back to the states. But the fact is, this is a movement that is not going to stop there. They want to criminalize abortion across the country, and they will just immediately shift to the state level battles and then move the goalposts at the national level to try to get fertilized eggs declared to be legal people under the 14th Amendment, which would make abortion and many forms of birth control the legal equivalent of murder and would leave women subject to harassment and punishment for having miscarriages, which happens in other countries that operate under that kind of legal regime. For same-sex couples and their families, the idea of having the legal protections of marriage stripped away from them is really threatening and can undermine those families in all kinds of ways, very practically, from healthcare to parental rights and everything else. So seeing the right-wing takeover of the Supreme Court move to a new level is going to be harmful for all kinds of Americans. You know, if the Affordable Care Act is overturned, millions of Americans will lose access to health care. Millions of people with pre-existing conditions will lose that protection in spite of what Trump is saying on the campaign trail. So the threat is very real. You're right. I think many people did not understand in 2016 just how devastating it would be if Trump and the right-wing legal movement were given free rein to remake the courts. But, you know, that's where we are. And we're going to have a lot of damage to repair. But to start repairing it, we really need to have Trump turned out of the White House in November and to have the Senate Republicans lose their majority. So those are two imperatives.
Well, I asked for it, and you gave it. It is something that keeps you awake at night. It certainly does me. Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at People for the American Way, an effective and tireless chronicler of the anti-American political religious right. He is finishing up an article right now about what we've been talking about, and we will link to it on stateofbelief.com. Peter, as always, you have given us what we ask you to do, and it does scare us, which we should be scared about. But thank you for what you continue to do. And it's always great to have you on with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Weldon.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. We are very grateful. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We'd love to hear from you. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.